This podcast contains swearing and occasional disturbing content.
I don't need to live in this physical realm. I walk around in the physical realm. In the spiritual world is where I live. I exist in places you never even dreamed of. Strange.
And welcome to the Holy Strangers Podcast, Episode 7. My name is Gav.
And my name's Sarah.
And we are here to talk about holiday destination-y, hotel-y thingies. It's that time of the year, ladies and gentlemen, lovely listeners, where we like to go on holiday. Well, we can if there's not a pandemic sweeping across the world.
In full quarantine soon.
Yeah. The places we go to, we like to go to the beach, we like to get our little buckets or spades or things like this, and we do lots of little stuff like that. We do other holidays. Some people might go to a theme park stuff, but generally what you have to do when you go on these holidays is stay in things called hotels or motels.
Indeed.
You know, we don't have to camp and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But we're talking about a hotel today. I didn't ever think I'd do a podcast and spend a couple of hours chatting about a hotel.
Yeah.
But we are. We're talking about the Cecil Hotel. I say like that because Sarah keeps calling it Cecil, and I watched the documentaries, and it was Cecil. But we didn't know if that was an American pronunciation or an English pronunciation.
Yeah. So I'm going to be going with Cecil Hotel throughout the podcast, regardless of whether I'm right or wrong. I'm just going to be belligerent about it and just go, it's the Cecil Hotel.
And just to be colourful and adventurous like I am, an extreme, I'm going to be Cecil Hotel, yeah. just to funk it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Just for the giraffe.
Well, that's cool. At least we're getting both pronunciations in there. So if one of us is incorrect or whatever, at least they're both in there.
Yeah, definitely.
We're covering our ass.
And you've done a ton of research on this one.
Oh, I've done loads. I've done so much research. It took ages, but it's really interesting as well. I've always been interested in this hotel because it's just bizarre. It's so strange how it can have attracted so much misfortune, I suppose.
Mm.
And yeah, I do find it really interesting. So it was good to do the research.
Well, it's interesting because you came to me saying, let's do this.
Yeah.
And the best thing is this, it's not just a case. Last time we did Golden State, where it's literally one case where the same things happen
but in
repeatedly. This is different types of research, different types of weirdness out there.
Yeah.
Someone weirdly on CCTV, which we get to Lisa Lamb, that whole thing is completely different to Richard Ramirez and what he was there.
Yeah.
Which is completely different for people who jump off the building to commit suicide for the reason that they're there. It just happens to be a place where, and like in Ghostbusters, isn't like the building just happens to be Dana Barrett's apartment.
Oh,
that building
like
happens to just be a building.
Yeah, it's the gateway.
Yeah, yeah. So that may be the Cecil Hotel.
Yeah, it could be.
That's what I'm going to keep doing as well. Cecil. That's how I say it. Maybe that's the gateway. Maybe you just need some terror dogs there.
Yeah.
Gatekeepers.
Yeah. Keymaster.
Yeah. Get together.
You're well away.
Have a pie. Have a little key orgy.
Oh.
What have you been up to? Well, what have we been up to?
Well, yeah.
We went to the cinema again.
We did. We went to the cinema and watched Nightmare on Elm Street, didn't we? The original.
The original movie, Nightmare on Elm Street in the cinema. It was quite nice to see it on a big screen.
It was all right, actually.
But we did come out of it afterwards. I know this might be controversial, ladies and gentlemen, if you're a horror fan. We came out of it sort of going, what? Seemed a little crap in places.
It wasn't that great.
It just
was
seemed
it?
Weird on the big screen where we watched Aliens recently, and that was fantastic.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to go and watch The Shining as well, and that was amazing. So seeing all these films on the big screen, feel
indeed.
Really lucky.
Yeah.
And watch Pulp Fiction with my lad as well at cinema. That was awesome.
And that's because these new films haven't been able to come out yet so much because of what's going
cinema.
On. So some change of cinema starting up. This
just
is obviously just UK.
The
I know doing stand drive-ins. I'm about to say stand-up. Stand-up film. Hello.
Not going to a stand-up cinema.
That'd be weird.
Sod that.
God, fuck that. Yeah. Anyway, that's kind of what we were doing. It's not really much, is it? Last time we did a bit of rando noughting, didn't we?
Yeah, just been like decorating and crocheting. And that's been my world.
I've just seen a cat.
Scale a
mattress which is vertically against a wall. Just scale up it, no problem. Wait for her to jump on my head.
She'll be up there for the rest of the day now.
Right.
She can stay there as well. Bloody pigeon murderer.
She was a pigeon murderer earlier.
Not happy with that cat.
I tried. I did my best.
You did. In vain.
Right, so Cecil Hotel.
Okay.
So it's a weird one. So this is I can give some information on the backstory. Well, not really the backstory of the location, ladies and gentlemen. Normally I have to ask it, but we're in LA for this one. I went to Skid Row a couple of years ago. I drove for it. It's weird that only a few miles away is Beverly Hills, and it's one extreme of one side of money, and then the other scale of side of money is Skid Row, and it's just like, how can this be a thing in the real world?
Weird. I would like to go. I'd like to go and have a look. I'd quite like to go and stay in this hotel as well. Obviously, it's not the Cecil anymore. It's called the Stay on Main.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, changed its name. It's kind of been rebranded.
Because of the controversy. Especially, is this before or after Lisa? Because that was 2017, was it, Lisa?
Yeah, when she stayed there, it was called the Stay on Main.
Oh, it was already.
So it had already changed its name.
Jesus, they'll probably have to change it again soon.
Yeah, but I would definitely like to go and stay there. I think that would be quite interesting.
And I've been down Skid Row, and it's a drove through it, and it's what you imagine. It's generally a huge populace of homeless people who have made tents on the sidewalk down either side. So it's like you're driving down a street of houses, but they're tents. And they've made it a thing, you know. But obviously, you know, anything goes down there.
Yeah.
You know, anything's
going
to go.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
There's going to be bums bumming each other and all sorts.
Oh, my God.
You know. So that's the sort of thing. And this hotel is slap bang in the middle. Now, Skid Row wasn't always Skid Row, was it? It wasn't always...
No, I would think
because
like it was just a
it
general...
It was just a general road, of course, where it was built. They're not going to build a hotel. Go, this is a good place to build a hotel. But this wasn't a thing in the 20s. Was it the 20s?
It was the 20s. Well, obviously, the guy who built it had like high aspirations for it at the time.
Of course.
Because it was the Facebook.
And
the
when you say high aspirations, it was a tall building, wasn't it, at the time?
You can see from the pictures I put up on the Facebook page, you know, obviously the interior.
It looks grand.
It looks amazing. Yeah. It's all marble, you know, big staircases. It was really, like, of its time, you know. It was really, like, obviously this dude spent, like, quite a lot of money building this place.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just all turned to shit. So, bad for him. Poor bugger.
Yeah.
There you go. It was built in 1924 by hotelier William Banks Hanna and designed by a guy called Loy Lester Smith in the Beaux Arts style, which is kind of like the Art Deco-y kind of style that it's in. He spent $1 million to build it.
In 1924,
but in today money, that's $13 million.
I would have actually thought that was going to be more.
Yeah. Yeah, you would think, wouldn't you? Because it's like it really looks really fancy. Mm. So yeah, it had an entirely marble lobby, stained glass windows, and sweeping staircases. It's 19 stories high, and that's as high as was allowed at the time. That is the very highest building that they could build at that time. It's 19 stories, and it has over 700 rooms. So it's a fair size. It's massive.
In fact, you've got 700 rooms. It's 700 rooms you need to furnish.
Yeah, totally.
It's 700 rooms that you need to occupy with potential customers, and 700 rooms you need to keep clean on a daily basis, and that's 700 sets of washing linen. So basically, you're looking at
it's a lot
enormous
of
place that needs to be... I don't like saying the word manned. It needs to be humaned.
Yeah,
personed. By... a large scale group.
Definitely. I mean, obviously,
so you're looking at a lot of money should be coming through there,
aspirations for it.
Absolutely.
Because if he made it that big, you know, he's probably fairly confident that people were going to come and stay there. So must have been quite a well-to-do area, you know, lots of people kind of passing through. Yeah, I was really confident in that. But within 5 years, the Great Depression hit.
Now, that's obviously a financial depression.
Yeah, so where... it started in the US after a major fall in stock prices. It began around 1929 and became, like, worldwide. It affected everybody. The stock market crash of October in 29, known as Black Tuesday.
Oh, right, okay.
And apparently over 7 million people died during the Great Depression.
Through poverty and starvation.
Just be poverty and stuff, wouldn't it? Starvation, not being able to eat. Life expectancy was about 50 years in that kind of age.
Then. And obviously, that's not what... How long after it had been built?
It was built in 1924, and that was 1929.
Wow. So five years' time, the building that we just discussed that needed to be having money, a huge quantity of high percentage of money flown through on a daily basis, has now been wiped out.
Nothing,
So it's going to be them going, how do we get customers? We're going to have to drop rent. And what happens when you drop rent? You're going to get all sorts of people who need somewhere to stay.
So it was popular and it was fashionable through the 1940s, but the future years would see it decline as the surrounding area that came to be called Skid Row became increasingly populated with transients. And as many as 10...
Transients are just travelling folk who just come from different places.
That's it. Not necessarily homeless people that live there,
it's
but
just,
people
it's
kind
people
of passing,
passing through.
But
some of them staying,
It was served by a lot of bus routes and stuff, so there was a high traffic of people going through. So it was good for homeless people to kind of panhandle, you know, and get money.
Yeah.
People are passing through on and off the buses all the time. You can kind of, like, drift around, you know. It's easy for them to get money, so therefore... like homeless and transients kind of gathered there, and as many as 10,000 homeless people lived within a 4 mile radius.
Within a 4 mile, right. Well, you got to remember that a reason to stop there is like LA has, Los Angeles has always been for a very long time, where films were made.
Yeah.
It's just the place where films around the world were made from very early, from the silent era going into the sound era.
And then
Universal was
people,
very high in Los Angeles in the 20s and stuff.
People
like
kind of going and wanting to be movie stars.
There's
and
that,
stuff,
and the ones
know,
that never made it and ended up just turning to drinking, not turning to them, but maybe just like, oh, I'll get wasted tonight and end up
just
getting
kind
addicted or whatever happens. And also, the people who are in a film business have a lot of money. And it's Hollywood, and it's in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is quite a large scale. I can't remember the mile diameter. Radius of it, but they would have money, so asking people for money or stuff like that is going to be more high chance you're going to get it because they've got the money than then saying go to another city. New York you probably could as well, but this you can see how this would be a place to say, and the weather's good, so that's the other thing for homeless out there. You can have these tents and things outside. It's not like in England for us, weather's awful, it can get really bad. You can't. You know, we can't have swimming pools. Go to LA. The swimming pools, everyone's back garden. So it's a good place to stop.
Yeah.
If you're homeless.
Yeah.
Absolutely no doubt. Or you just don't have a home and you're traveling or whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
Perfect place. So this was like the mecca, this Skid Row place.
Yeah.
So then this huge, massive fucking hotel is just planted in the middle of it.
Yeah, that's it. It's there. Just as a little aside, I did find out something quite interesting. George Takei, who's Sulu from Star Trek, lived on Skid Row when he was 8 years old.
When he was eight?
Yeah, around 1945 he was there.
So
For 5 years. Him and his family.
When they
came over and they lived there.
Wow.
Yeah, so he lived on Skid Row for 5 years.
Maybe it was the thing to do, like go there, everyone else is in the same boat there.
Yeah, totally.
Just be prepared for anything is going to happen. But.
Yeah, well, it's a start, I suppose, isn't it? If you haven't got anything.
Well, he did okay, didn't he?
He did all right, bless him. Yeah, pulled himself up, didn't he?
Well, he's a name people know.
Yeah, totally. So, come on, fucking hell.
Fair play.
By the 1950s, the hotel had gained a reputation as a residence for transients. Yeah. So, it's built it in 1924, obviously, Depression in 29. Mid-30s, I suppose, things may be starting to come back a bit. But by 1950s, it's marked as a residence for people who are transient or, not very well off. Hmm. So, yeah, it's a shame. Shame for older... What was his name? William Banks Hannah.
Hmm.
In 2007, so we're coming up to present day now.
God, that's been a quick podcast.
Oh, yeah.
That's today's episode, ladies and gentlemen.
Don't you worry. I've got plenty more to come. This is just about the actual building itself, So we're going to get into, the history of everything else that comes next.
Okay.
So 2007, part of the hotel was refurbished after the new owners took over. In 2011, the Cecil was rebranded as the Stay on Main. In 2014, the hotel was sold to New York hotelier Richard Bourne for $30 million. And another New York-based firm acquired a 99-year lease on the property. The president of that firm said he was committed to preserving the architectural and historically significant areas of the hotel, but is planning on renovating the Cecil and adding a rooftop pool and gym. Construction is planned to be complete by about 2021, so it'll be a mix of hotel rooms and residential units.
A rooftop pool and gym, do you think that's needed after Lisa Lamb
swimming in there after her in the bloody water tank?
Exactly.
Poor taste, Richard Bourne.
When I wasn't allowed, like, she did go up to someone's hotel, and I got an Uber to this hotel, and then I opened up the door and I chat to the Uber driver on the way. They end up saying I make music and all stuff, and they end up giving a CD and these are all excited and stuff. And then he got out, I shake my hand or stuff, and it looked like he was I know these other people, it's this sort of hotel where other people looking, because they're looking for celebrities and exactly.
Yeah, of course.
And I went into this massive front bit and it's just like, oh my god, and all these bell hops going along with the big trolleys, all gorgeous.
Oh, weird.
And met my friend and we went up to her apartment, and it's just this huge, massive thing. She was there for work and stuff, and then went out and there was like a pool on top of the roof, and it's just crazy. I've not seen this sort of shit, So don't have that in a Premier Inn,
definitely.
In Southampton or something, do you?
So in February 2017, the LA City Council voted to deem the Cecil a historic cultural monument because it's representative of an early 20th century hotel and because of its architecturally significant work. So, yeah, it's not going to be knocked down or anything, it's quite safe. Which is good, because he spent a lot of money on it, but as well, the time that must have gone into that, it's frigging beautiful inside. It's so pretty.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
To knock that down is a big, massive job, though, if it's that high.
Yeah.
And also, I guess you can't go any much higher because there's a big earthquake.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
A thing going on there, which you do get that happening. Yeah. So anything to is probably, I guess that's probably a factor involved.
I should have had a look, shouldn't I, and see what was, how much the building height
regulation
has increased, if it has at all, over time. I wonder if you're allowed to go any bigger now, or whether it's
might
still
be
at
through,
19
through
stories.
More sturdier materials, possibly.
Yeah.
But to be honest, they probably did a good job.
I can't imagine
then.
It's gone up by much, like you say.
Not really. Yeah, if anything,
and shit.
Might have even gone down.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Okay, so that is the Cecil Hotel.
So that's the building itself.
I'd say Cecil as well. Cecil Hotel. That's the building itself and its location.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is. It sounds like, why the fuck are you doing a podcast episode or talking about a fucking hotel?
Mm.
This, it's like evil resides there in the foundations,
it's
doesn't it?
It's
all
so
mystery,
weird.
It's like, darkness rather than evil. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know if it's
Richard Ramirez, you put him as class as evil.
But you've got to think the area that it's in, is it the building itself, or is it just the fact that the area that it's in attracts so many kind of undesirables, I suppose, because you're on Skid Row.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, like, because it's like they would have had to lower prices to,
of course,
because they need to keep things flowing. And if you're gonna do, if you're gonna drop prices, that means like obviously other people can come in there for possibly homeless people have got a little bit of money, and but that also means that the staff, their prices, they go up. We can't afford to pay that much.
Yeah.
You're gonna get a lower class of staff.
Yeah, and also I think they would do.
So who might be the type of people who might be up for corruption? Like, I'll give us a few quid. Or might just look away or just doesn't give a shit, like with Richard Maris walking back and forwards in the nude.
It's always been kind of like people, you know, they'll turn a blind eye.
Yeah. But and like, if they don't get paid that much, they'd be like, oh, I don't really give a shit.
Well, this is it. I think they do kind of like weekly rates and they do hourly rates as well. So obviously hourly rates is going to be for prostitution and stuff like that. So it can go in there for an hour.
Yeah.
Pay for a room, you know. So it's going to be like unsavoury people that are going in there, you know. And obviously then the staff are going to turn a blind eye because that's an illegal activity, you know. But they want the money, don't they? So.
Yeah, this sounds like I'm some sort of jet set. I was in San Francisco when I was staying at a hotel. Got it for happened to get this one place for 2 weeks, and it's on the Tenderloin, which is in the same sort of San Francisco, which is the same sort of thing as Skid Row.
Honestly,
but the people next to me, I don't know how I knew this. Did I talk to them? I'm not sure. That they'd been there for a couple of years.
Shit, really?
There's a family. And they lived in the room.
That's crazy.
Yeah, you can do that stuff as well. And they would just live there. And that's like, it's kind of like our rent. If they're paying.
Yeah.
And it's weekly rates and just pay each week.
That's insane. Like, obviously, I know that kind of shit goes on. We don't have it over here, do we?
But it's just you do whatever you can, I guess.
Yeah.
And they just made it their own. You know.
Bonkers.
But also, I did wake up one morning, look outside my window and see a homeless person jack up some heroin and just pass out on his trolley.
Nice.
And I was like, right, let's start the day.
I would like to go and stay there though, just because I want to see it.
Yeah.
Randomly, I know most people will go, I'm going to avoid that, but I don't know. I like looking at things. I like looking at stuff that happens, whether it's like see
people just pissing on the street.
But I just want to see like the general area. Do you know what I mean? It'd be good. I like to look at pretty things. I want to go and look at nice, interesting things. But
you're not
going to
see pretty things
in
the Tenderloin.
Interesting as well. It's like the other side to it, isn't it? It's like as bad as things can get.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just I think it's good
to have
that.
It's real life.
Yeah, to have that balance and see. I don't know. That's just the way my brain works.
Yeah, listeners, we don't know what's going on inside that brain.
No, you don't want to know. You don't want to know.
You told me last night when you were younger.
Oh, no.
And you wet yourself.
What about my dream of kaleidoscope toilets?
Kaleidoscope toilets. You woke up and you'd wet yourself. I wet myself. And like the Tenderloin is like you got this Tenderloin, this really kind of weird area. You literally walk around the corner, you're in Market Street, Market Street, then the business section's just there.
Yeah.
And again, it's like with Beverly Hills and Skid Row, it's just like the divide is just a line of wealth. It's just so insane. But anyway, let's get back to.
Yes, let's go back to the
So sizzle. What is our first weird thing going on there?
Right, so remember this place was built in 1929. Okay, so we're going to start off with these, with a suicide, and that is November 19th, 1931. So literally...
Less than 10 years after being built.
Not even that, 2 years. It went, 1924. So yeah. What's that? 8 years. So, 8 years later, obviously, we've had the Great Depression and stuff, so people are starting to come back and stay here now. So, November 19th, 1931, W.K. Norton was 46, and he was found dead in his room after ingesting poison capsules.
Poison? What's poison?
Poison capsules. A week prior, he had checked into the Cecil under the name James Willis, from Chicago. Norton's death appears to be the earliest recorded.
So obviously we're speaking about the depression, that sort of thing would, because I, when you first told me about it and we were discussing doing the episode, and I was like, oh well, okay, well, depression, that, and you say the tallest building, you can see where people are like, oh, I'm gonna jump off it, so that's what I thought, but you're like, no, it wasn't just jumping off. So the first one is just happened to be happenstance, the hotel that this particular gentleman picked.
Well, apparently people are 19 times more likely to commit suicide in a hotel.
Why? Because it's not their own.
It's not their house, because people that find them aren't going to be their family.
Yeah, and...
You know, they've got no actual connection to it. It's kind of a step away, isn't it, from making it as personal as that. You know, if you kill yourself in your house...
Yeah, people got
to
find it.
Are you then going to want people to move in after that, you know? Yeah. So it's kind of like, But yeah, 19 times more likely.
I wonder if I've stayed in a hotel room where someone's done that, you know?
More than likely. I mean, I wouldn't expect so in places like the Premier Inn, but I would have thought like more kind of homey hotels, or like obviously places like this that have got a high traffic area, you know, and they've got people coming through or have been there for a long time, then yeah, it's more likely.
Yeah, it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So this dude just poisoned himself.
Yeah, he ingested poison capsules.
Do you know any reason why?
No, there's no reason for it. There's no note left.
That's the trouble, because it's quite long ago. You know,
yeah, some people leave notes, some just don't. They just do it, don't they? In September 1932, a maid found Benjamin Dodick, 25, dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head.
Benny Dodick?
Yep. He didn't leave a note. So that's another one.
And how did he die, sorry?
He shot himself in the head.
Shot himself?
Yeah.
Okay. And how... And this was... What year, sorry?
19...
I shouldn't listen to the first time
I
said
it. No, 1932.
A year later.
So that's a year later.
Right.
In 1933, a young truck driver was crushed to death by his truck against the wall of the Cecil.
Okay, that's an accident.
That is an accident, but it did happen.
Yep, okay. So every year we've got death.
Yep, carrying that on with late July 1934, former Army Medical Corps Sergeant Louis D. Borden, 53, was found dead in his room at the Cecil. He had slashed his throat with a razor. Borden left several notes, one of which cited poor health as the reason for his suicide. But when they found him, they said he appeared to be in good health. They couldn't find any...
Yes, no. It was mental health.
Yeah.
That was the thing that... They didn't find any physical. Yeah. That's because it was mental. That's exactly the reason.
Yeah, because that's quite like...
But to slash your own throat...
If he's been in the army as well, he's probably got PTSD.
Exactly. That's
quite a vicious method of suicide, isn't it, really?
That's exactly
like, surely if you're going to top yourself, you'd do your wrists in the bath, maybe, if you're going to head that way.
Yeah, no. Slit your own wrists is, you know, slit your own throat. That's going, I'm fucking doing this job. But that's also making a huge mess.
Totally.
So I'm going with total mental illness.
Yeah.
Because we physically couldn't find anything. Boss, he's all right. I don't know why he sounds like that. The policeman is checking.
Sound like a fast talking high trousers. 1930s.
That's it. I'm going for mental health for that. But again, that's another suicide. So that's a death on a yearly basis from
31, 32, 33, 34.
Okay.
So in March, we're skipping a few years now, in March 1937, Grace E. Magro fell from a ninth story window. Her fall was broken by telephone wires which wrapped around her body, and that didn't kill her, she was still alive. She later died at the now demolished Georgia Street Receiving Hospital. Police were unable to determine whether Magro's death was the result of an accident or a suicide, so they don't know if she fell or if she jumped.
Okay.
But it didn't kill her. She got wrapped up in the phone wires and taken to hospital and then died later.
Gutted.
Mm.
If you were going to commit suicide, damn it.
There's a crazy one coming up. If you don't know about it, you're going to be like, what the fuck?
I do know about it.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Oh, God damn it.
Well, listeners, don't they?
So in January 1938, United States Marine Corps Fireman Roy Thompson, 35... jumped from the Cecil's top floor and was found on the skylight of a neighbouring building. He had been staying at the Cecil for several weeks. So I don't know how he got onto the roof of a neighbouring building.
No, the buildings are quite close.
Are they? Okay.
Well, when we get to Lisa Lamb, someone filmed a video and they're saying up the other roofs. Oh, no. Because there was the... Was it the immediate building next to it was really close and it had a tower and you could go climb onto the other side or things like that? Yeah, I think so.
Maybe it just kind of...
Yeah.
In May 1939...
Was he committing suicide?
Yeah.
But he was on the another building. So it could have just been as he jumped and wind or...
It must be quite windy up there.
As you come down on a very tall towers, like a Canary Wharf in London, very, 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 very high towers, all in the vicinity of each other.
Yeah.
At the ground levels you walk through, it's like fucking hurricanes at times.
Really?
Because the wind just goes like a vortex all together and pushes together because of the tall buildings, it pushes downwards.
Okay.
So that could have
gusted him over pushed to him the over. Next one.
Yeah.
So skipping another couple of years now, in May 1939, Navy officer Erwin C. Neblett, 39, was found dead in his room after ingesting poison. So we've got another one who's poisoned himself.
Okay.
January 1940, teacher Dorothy Skiger, 45, ingested poison while staying at the Cecil and was reported by the Los Angeles Times to be near death. No further reports were published on her condition. So she got found and she wasn't dead. So we don't know if she'd actually died because there's no further reports.
Okay.
The paper said she's near death, but didn't say that she'd died.
Okay.
So attempted suicide or suicide. Excuse me. This one's a bit of a weird one as well. In September 1944, Dorothy Jean Purcell, 19, was sharing a room with her boyfriend, shoe salesman Ben Levine, 38. Purcell woke in the night with terrible stomach pains and got up to use the bathroom. Unaware that she was even pregnant and had gone into labour, she gave birth to a baby boy. Thinking the baby was dead and also not wanting to wake her boyfriend... and also not wanting to explain the baby, she threw the baby out of the window where he landed on an adjacent roof. The baby wasn't actually born dead, so it was still alive when she did this, but it died shortly after, and Purcell was charged with murder.
So she was charged murder of her own child?
Yeah. She threw it out
because
the window.
Because she just didn't want to upset her...
She didn't want to upset the guy.
Because we've got to think of then and how things were.
Yeah, totally.
And that whole like, oh no, he's the man.
Yeah,
I'm the woman.
She's having a child out of wedlock as well. You know, she's only 19, he's 38. So it's a bit of a situation. But yeah, to throw it out the window is just fucked up, isn't it?
How do you know you're not pregnant?
I know. I've heard so many stories of women not knowing that they're pregnant and they go into labour, and I just don't get it. I don't understand. Obviously, having had two kids myself, I was well aware that I was pregnant.
I actually do know someone who was quite pregnant who didn't realise.
Shit.
Yeah.
What a shocker, though.
They were quite young as well.
What a shocker. You'd just be like, what the fuck, wouldn't you? Start going into labour. Insane.
Yeah, I see their kid around and stuff. It's like 17 or whatever now.
Fucking hell. Mm. Three psychiatrists testified that she was mentally confused at the time of the incident. And in January 1945, she was found not guilty by reason of insanity.
Probably went insane after hearing what was going on. That must be such a thing. It's as a mother giving birth, then really think about it afterwards, going, oh my god, it's my child, and it would drive you crazy.
Yeah. And especially like after immediately giving birth as well, because obviously it just happened. You know, she woke up, she had stomach pains, she went into labour and she gave birth. To have all of that happen and you don't even know And then immediately go, you've got all this kind of stuff going through your mind, going, shit, what am I going to do with this? And you're just like, fucking lob it out the window and go back to bed. That's like, I don't know. That would make you insane, I'm sure. You'd go mad.
Yeah, well, keeping it silent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Well, that's a horrible case.
Yeah, it's bloody awful, isn't it?
Yeah, that's horrible.
In November 1947, Robert Smith, 35, died after jumping from one of the Cecil's seventh floor windows.
Okay.
October 22nd, 1954, San Francisco stationery firm employee Helen Gurney, 55, jumped from the window of her seventh floor room and landed on top of the Cecil's marquee. So it's a bit out the front, the awning above the door, I think.
Okay.
1 week prior, she had registered at the hotel under the name Margaret Brown. February the 11th, 1962, Julia Frances Moore, 50, jumped from the window of her eighth floor room and landed in a second story interior light well. She did not leave a suicide note, and among her possessions were a bus ticket from St. Louis, 59 cents in change, and an Illinois bank book showing a balance of $1,800.
That's a bit of money.
Yeah, she's got a few quid, so...
Dollars?
Yeah.
Bucks?
On October 12th, 1962, Pauline Otten, 27, jumped from the window of her ninth floor room after an argument with her estranged husband, Dewey. He had left the room prior to Otten's suicide. Otten landed on passerby George Giannini, 65, killing them both instantly. As there were no witnesses, police initially thought that it was a double suicide. They thought they'd done it together.
Both jumpers, yeah.
But when they investigated further, they found out Giannini still had his hands in his pockets and his shoes on.
Yeah.
So then they figured that she landed on him. Fucked up. That one's so fucked up. It's like,
yeah,
that poor dude.
Because
like, obviously wouldn't have had time to think about it. But shit, that's just crap.
So it'd be the landing, but the shoes would have gone flying. So that's how they knew the shoes.
Yeah, apparently you either lose them on the way down, or when you land, the impact will knock your shoes off, blow your socks off.
Yeah. So poor dude's just walking by.
Yeah, just out for a fucking stroll.
Just going for a walk, dear.
And don't fucking come back, because some bloody nutty bird who's jumped out the window's landed on you.
Of course, a lovely day today.
Yeah, la 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 la.
What's that?
Squash.
Wow. Fucking hell.
Insane.
Yeah, yeah. So things are getting weirder.
Yeah, there's a few weird ones.
We started
ones,
up with not just general suicide.
Oh.
You know.
This one's a bit rough as well. On June the 4th, 1964... a hotel worker discovered Pigeon Goldie Osgood, a retired telephone operator, dead in her room. She'd been raped, stabbed and beaten, and her room was ransacked. Osgood was well known around the area and had earned her nickname because she fed the birds in nearby Pershing Square. Hours after her murder, Jacques B. Hellinger, 29, was seen walking through the same square in bloodstained clothing. He was arrested and charged with Osgood's murder, but was later cleared of the crime, and the murder has never been solved.
Okay. So that's our first murder victim in the hotel. It's all been suicide, someone getting run over.
Yeah, it's all been suicide up to now, so in 64.
Well, murder, I suppose, with the baby, but that wasn't an intentional violent thing. This is the first violent criminal activity murder. Okay.
And on December 20th, 1975, a still unidentified woman, approximately 23 years old, jumped from the 12th floor window onto the Cecil's second floor roof. She had registered at the hotel on December 16th under the name Alison Lowell.
Okay.
And on September the 1st, 1992, a man was found deceased in the alley behind the Cecil. Authorities believe he either fell, jumped, or was pushed from the hotel's 15th floor window, and the man's true identity has never been established.
Okay. Hey, I'll just keep saying, okay. Okay, after each suicide attempt and murder.
Yeah, so that's it. That's it for the suicides now.
There's not been any more suicides since?
No, that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right, that's strange that there's not been any more since then.
Yeah.
Okay, I wonder why that is.
I don't know. That's quite bizarre, but yeah, there's no more recorded after that, so...
Because that was a lot in succession.
Yeah, so like for about 30 years, it's like quite continuous, isn't it?
Yeah, with two deaths and one accidental, but mainly suicide, yeah. Okay, so this the old Cecil Cecil Hotel.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a hotspot for death.
It is, yeah. So it's gained its reputation as lots of death there in general.
And this is not going to obviously help the business side of things.
No, I can't imagine it would. Okay. Unless you like gore hounds like me, you go, I want to go and stay there.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, as well as all the death from suicide and that kind of stuff, there's been some pretty unsavoury characters staying at the Cecil. We're going to talk about this guy who's quite well known, Richard Ramirez.
The Night Stalker.
Yeah, Screen Door Intruder.
Screen Door Intruder is not a great name.
No,
Night Stalker's a good one.
So we had the original Night Stalker last time, didn't we? And now we've got the proper Night Stalker.
So this is another serial killer.
Yeah.
He looks like evil.
He does,
Gacy.
Yeah.
Gacy looks like kind of a fun sort of... And it looks a bit like a pedo, but he
Ed
just kind of looks...
Ed Kemper as well. Ed Kemper's just like a big bumbler, isn't he?
Big butt Ed Kemper.
Yeah.
They're just that. But this Ramirez, you can see a picture of him. He just... Because he has almost like sort of pointy odd teeth, doesn't he? For much as I believe.
He had monkey teeth.
Okay.
Everybody who survived, who had kind of been near him, did comment
bad
on
breath.
The fact his breath fucking stunk.
Obviously, he
but
just didn't brush his teeth or anything.
Some of the women that he attacked and survived actually said that he was quite sexy. I know that people, like, obviously, will get on to Pete, like, women write into him when he's arrested and kind of will go into that.
He's saying sort of Stockholm syndrome, as such. But, like, post Stockholm syndrome ish,
yeah,
or saying, like, that he
of.
Actually is kind of sexy.
But there was a couple of women that said that he was quite sexy. I think one woman said that he smelled like wet leather. Oh, which is a bit weird.
He smelled like wet leather.
Yeah, imagine that. It's just like, oh. What is wrong with these women?
Yeah, and maybe it was like his persona, his aura here had a magnifying, magnetic thing to him. And
yeah.
Maybe.
Could
and then he
be.
Spoke and everyone went, oh, man.
Yeah.
That's a mouthwash.
Yeah.
But he looks like evil, if you've looked at this dude.
He does.
So he wasn't very nice.
No, he was rather unpleasant.
What did he get up to then, dear?
Okay, so he had 14 victims in total.
Sorry, let's have a cup of tea, dear, and discuss.
Yeah,
should we discuss Ramirez today?
Oh. he had 14 victims in total. He was a serial killer, serial rapist, and a burglar who terrorised the residents of LA and later San Francisco from April 1984 until August 1985.
So only a year. He was busy.
But how famous is he, and how fucking prolific as well to have 14 victims?
Well, it does help when the press give you names. Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Gets them out there in the public consciousness quite a bit more, doesn't it?
Some of these killers try and do, don't they?
Yeah.
And they don't get the names.
They want
gutted.
The infamy, yeah, definitely.
Because they just, oh, I don't know what else I could do to be famous. Kill people.
So he was dubbed the Night Stalker, the Walk-In Killer, the Valley Intruder, and the Screen Door Intruder.
He's quite into old Satan and that, wasn't he?
He was. And I'm a bit annoyed about the
connotation.
Yeah, definitely, because I'm a Satanist, I'm a member of a satanic temple, and it's just not what we're about at all. We're not out there eating people's babies. You know, it's a decent thing. And this kind of gives it a bad name. You know, so it's a bit annoying. I'm a bit annoyed at old Richie. At least he got his pentagram the right way round.
But this was coming off the whole America was very much
satanic panic, all that
satanic
kind of
panic.
Stuff.
And that was going on, and that was a massive thing.
That's still
70s.
A thing now, though. You
it
know,
is, but it's more, it's more... More
people
things are more
are
widely
more
accepted
educated,
today.
Yeah,
educated, and not so, there's not so much naivety.
But
so.
Yeah, it's still it's still kind of there.
But at the time, that would have been. So he himself might have been just coming off of that sort of thing as well,
rather than being actually like, you know, that he would know that would have caused such fear. You know, he was using it more as a thing to instill fear or the shock value.
Didn't he draw pentagrams and shit?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he did. I kind of know a little bit about this dude.
Okay, well, we're going to get into him now. We're going to have a little dive into Richard Ramirez's life. It's bloody bonkers. Honestly, it's no wonder he was fucking nutbag. His life was just so fucked up. So he was born on the 29th of February, 1960. His birthday's near mine. So 6 days after mine.
I don't know what to say. Congratulations.
He was born in El Paso, Texas, and he was the youngest of 5 kids. He was strongly influenced by his older cousin, Miguel, also known as Mike, who was a decorated U.S. Army Green Beret combat vet. And when he was 12 years old, Mike started showing him Polaroids of all the Vietnamese women he'd been raping and beheading.
That's nice.
I know. So what? Richard's 12 years old at this time. So and obviously, who is that? That's his older cousin.
Hi, so older cousin. What have you been up to? Like, got some bitches for you.
All this shit, you know.
And how old is he to see this?
He's 12.
He's 12 years old.
All this runs through the family because, like, obviously he's been out there doing that kind of stuff, the cousin, you know, and then to come back and show him pictures and think it's, like, a good thing.
Yeah, well, he's looking... Well,
obviously, Richard's looking up to him to see how to behave, and so he must be like, "Oh, well,
you say he's obviously looking up to." Hopefully, he's obviously looking up to older siblings and father.
Yeah.
But then this dude comes back, and he's like you say, he's been in the war, so it's a bit more of a like, "Oh wow, you've been in the war." So this is what went on. And this dude was obviously off his fucking rock a little bit.
Yeah, but then you've got to wonder, like, if this guy's doing that kind of stuff, and he's got no filter to think, "Hang on, I shouldn't be showing a 12-year-old these pictures." You know, what's the rest of his family like?
This is what Vietnam.
What kind of situation is he growing up in?
Absolutely.
All of his family, you know.
And this is how the Vietnam War changed a lot of things when the media were actually showing the violence for the first time, and then soldiers come back and the PTSD. It changed a huge amount of things.
Yeah.
And to then have, like, because a lot of the soldiers were getting bad reps for doing this shit.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of them were doing this shit.
Yeah, definitely. So he's showing him all these pictures. So Richie's seeing that. He started smoking marijuana at the age of 10, and he bonded with Mike over joints and gory stories of war.
Imagine being stoned.
I know.
And looking at Polaroid pictures. It must have been crazy. Some really low-grade weed, because, Jesus Christ, a drive is going to make you go crazy.
Send you off on a whitey, wouldn't it? Fucking horrible.
Fucking rainbowy, rather than just a whitey.
Mike taught him some of his military skills as well, such as killing with stealth. So he's already teaching him the ways.
Why are you teaching a kid
how
to kill at stealth?
Showing off?
Well, obviously the guy's a complete prick. But what do you think that this kid's going to do with this knowledge?
It was also around this time that Ramirez began sleeping in a local cemetery to escape his father's explosive temper.
So he's got a shitty home life. I said looking up to father. Yeah, so he hasn't possibly got that thing to look up to. We don't know totally with the backstory, but he hasn't got his thing to look up to. So then, like you're saying, his character's come along and he's something to look up to.
Yeah.
What a thing to look up to, Al. Wow.
Ramirez was present on May the 4th, 1973, when his cousin Mike shot his wife Jessie in the face with a revolver during an argument. I think Ramirez was on the sofa and they were arguing, and dude just stood up and just blasted her in the face.
So what happened? Did the police turn up and take him away, the cousin?
Well, I'm assuming so, yeah. I think he did stay in there. He got put in the mental institution. We'll come to that anyway. Okay. I've got a bit about that, I think. Later that year, he moved in with his older sister Ruth and her husband Roberto, who was an obsessive peeping Tom, and he took Richie along with him on his nightly exploits. So he's gone from looking at Polaroids of beheading and raping to someone peeping. Who's a peeping Tom going out looking through windows.
Ted taking, Bundy style, taking having him a little with wank.
Him, taking him with him, wanking in the bushes. Ramirez also began using LSD and cultivated an interest in Satanism. So things are not going well for Richie, and he's like, what, 14 now? Something.
It's
like
not
that.
Like his education, playing with friends, riding around on bicycles and getting a job.
It's not usual kid shit at all.
So this is basically making a serial killer.
Yeah, definitely.
Because we've said before, like, the serial killer is generally the head trauma.
Yeah.
The abuse.
Yeah.
This isn't.
No, this is kind
is
of like
an impressionable
a different way about it.
Who's
yeah.
in a bad...
It's just got a shit situation. Every way he turns, his situation is just bullshit.
In fact, you call him Richie. Makes him sound a little less evil.
Mm. Don't get me wrong, though. This guy's a fucking... He's terrifying. He is scary. Like that guy the other time, you know, Golden State Killer. They're both fucking scary. The idea that someone could creep into your house when you're asleep and you wake up and they're there... You know, we all know what it's like when you just wake up. You're all groggy and fucking, you know, you've got someone...
Yeah, flashlight.
There, you've got no time to prepare.
No.
They're there, you know, and they're going to do some evil shit.
Just the idea of murder and killing someone else. Because, like, we're here for a very short time on the planet.
Yeah.
Then we come, we go, we reproduce, we make, carry generally a timeline of a follow-on of children and, you know, families and generations. And just to be like, well, I'm just gonna stop people's lives.
Yeah,
their little,
just
their own little life. I've got.
It.
In my little life, I'm just gonna stop other people's lives.
Yeah,
such a weird. Why
but
bother?
I don't know.
Do you know what I mean?
I
What's the point?
Know
Who gives
if,
a fuck? Why bother?
I don't know if people that do that would necessarily think in that way.
No, obviously not.
Because they're just kind of running on like
the models aren't there.
The basic brain, aren't they?
Yeah,
where they just want to do the things that. Impulse, you know, and the things that they think they need to do.
And you'd like to say, his situation, the way he'd been almost conditioned.
What else does he know?
His mind is only going to be flowing a certain route.
Yeah.
Moral compass is way off.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a shame. It's a shame that, you know.
Mm.
Like I said to you, Eve shouldn't have had the apple, should she?
Eve was weak.
Fuck you, Eve.
So Mike was found not guilty by reason of insanity. So that's his cousin who shot his wife in the face. He was released in 1977 after spending 4 years in the Texas State Mental Hospital, and his influence over Richard continued. So just straight back on it.
Because generally, especially then, it would have been just been cool, pump him with it for the drugs for the next 4 years, put him in there, he'd dribble away.
Yeah.
It's simple, easy. He doesn't bother us. He doesn't make no noise.
Yeah.
Then just come out and just go straight back.
Yeah.
Because obviously that hasn't done a thing.
Yeah. There's no rehabilitation.
All you've done is put a pause on it.
There's no cure. Not curing, but there's no helping. There's no therapy.
Not in the correct manner which we would have now for PTSD and it being recognised.
Yeah, totally. So while Richard was still at school, he took a job at a local holiday inn where he used his pass key to rob people while they were sleeping. So, yeah.
Hotel,
what is he now? He's
motel,
17 now.
Right.
His job ended when one of the guests returned to his room to find Ramirez attempting to rape his wife. Although the husband beat Ramirez senseless at the scene, the charges were dropped when the couple, who lived out of state, declined to return to testify. So he's basically just been given a pass there. He's just gone, right, I can do this, I can get away with it.
If I don't get caught.
Well, to him, that would be a pass. You know, he's got the charges dropped, so...
Yeah, but I'm saying, guys, by caught by husbands or other people at the particular point in time.
He dropped out of school in ninth grade, which in the UK, that's year 10, so he's about 14, 15 years old. And at the age of 22, he moved to California. So this is where he starts ramping up. April the 10th, 1984, Ramirez murdered a nine-year-old girl called Mei Lung in the basement of the hotel where he was living in the Tenderloin district of San Francisco. He raped and beat her before stabbing her to death and hanging her body from a pipe.
Fuck.
I know. Kid's like 9 years old.
Raped and beat a nine-year-old child.
Yeah. There's evidence of a second suspect who is believed to have been present at the time of the murder, but they haven't been publicly identified, and they're thought to be a juvenile at the time.
Not the cousin, then?
No, it's thought to be a younger person. Charges have not been brought due to the fact that there's not really any evidence. They can't really prove it, but they think that someone younger was present.
Okay.
So, yeah. June 28th, 1984, 79-year-old Jenny Vinkow was found brutally murdered in her apartment in Glassell Park, Los Angeles. She'd been stabbed repeatedly while she was asleep in her bed, and her throat had been slashed so deeply that she was almost decapitated. Ramirez's fingerprint was found on a mesh screen he'd removed to gain entry.
So, is it a nine-year-old girl to a 70-year-old lady?
But you will find this a lot of the time. It's people that can't defend themselves. People that
those
are going to be
are
easy.
Cases of...
It's
yeah.
A lot of times, it's older ladies.
Because the guy's a fucking pussy.
Yeah, because he hasn't... He just wants... You know, it's easy. They're not going to fight back. They're not going to put up any resistance. So, yeah.
And not have a husband there to beat them up.
Yeah. It's also during this time that Ramirez was living at the Hotel Cecil, and there are witnesses that said Ramirez used to walk through the hotel lobby in his underwear, or sometimes totally naked, just covered in blood, where he just dumped his clothes in the bin outside.
Yeah, and this is insane. This is the where we get to the lower wages staff who aren't going to give a fuck.
Yeah. Everyone just turned a blind eye.
They
you
could
know,
be
no
like,
oh,
I'm not going to... That's just more paperwork. I'm
yeah,
not getting
totally.
Into that. I'm not
it's more than,
ask,
your,
oh,
more
you,
than your job's worth, isn't it? To go up to some dude who's covered in blood walking through the lobby and go, you know, what the fuck? Obviously, there's something wrong with him.
But...
And you don't get paid enough to fucking do that shit.
But this is the thing, though, and you're going to see all this sort of stuff. When I was in the SF for San Francisco for quite a little while... The shit I saw.
Yeah, I can imagine. It must be crazy.
I saw crazy stuff all the time. And that was not a long span. So, like, I could be used to that stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously, nowadays, you feel like with the advent of smartphones, everybody seems to be social network policing and taking photos of anything possible. It's a Karen, take a picture, film them. They might go everybody's filming it. For nowadays, you're not someone could still do that, but someone's going to film it, then it's going to go back to the hotel, what's going on, then it's going to social police, media
people
police
people
would
be
are
gonna,
much
more you know, aware of it,
and then it would get shut down and it wouldn't happen blah blah blah. Then though,
back in the day, no one gives us a toss, do they? He was staying at the Cecil during all this time. He stayed there for about a year. On March 17th, 1985, Ramirez attacked 22-year-old Maria Hernandez in Rosemead, California, shooting her in the face with a 22-caliber handgun after she pulled into her garage. She did survive because she had her keys in her hand and she held her hand up to kind of protect her face, and the bullet ricocheted off the keys.
So
she was
so
fucking
ladies
lucky.
Ladies and gentlemen, if someone shoots you, it's worth putting your hands up. You
yeah,
never know.
Yeah, definitely. Inside the house, her roommate heard the shot and hid under the kitchen counter. When she raised her head to see what was going on, she saw Ramirez coming in the room. He shot her in the face and killed her. So he did kill that lady.
Should have stayed high hidden.
Yeah, should have stayed under the counter.
So he's not really... There's no been a weapon of choice or anything with this guy?
No, not particularly. Sometimes it's different. He does tend to use the gun quite a lot, but there will be different ones throughout. Within an hour of the Rosemead invasion, Ramirez pulled 30-year-old Veronica Yu out of her car in Monterey Park, shot her twice with a handgun and fled. She was pronounced dead upon arrival at the hospital, and the two murders and attempted third, all in the space of a day, attracted extensive media coverage, who dubbed the attacker the Walking Killer and the Valley Intruder. So that's all in the space of a day. He's off on one.
Mm.
He is, like, not so much spree killing, but really quick succession with his murders, obviously, to get 14 victims in just over a year.
And not be caught, yeah.
Yeah. On March 27th, 1985, Ramirez entered a home that he had burglarised a year earlier in Whittier at approximately 2 a.m. and killed the sleeping Vincent Zazara, who was 64, with a gunshot to the head. Zazara's wife, Maxine, 44, was awakened by the noise, and Ramirez beat her and bound her hands while demanding to know where her valuables were.
So he is obviously getting out of it also, but it seems to be pleasurable killing, but he's also also robbing them, getting stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
While he ransacked the room, Maxine escaped her bonds and retrieved a shotgun from under the bed, but it wasn't loaded. The infuriated Ramirez shot her 3 times with the handgun, then fetched a large carving knife from the kitchen. He mutilated her body by stabbing her several times, then he gouged out her eyes and placed them in a jewellery box, which he took with him. The autopsy determined the wounds were inflicted post-mortem. Ramirez left footprints from Avia trainers in the flower beds, which the police photographed and cast, and this was virtually the only evidence the police had at the time, apart from matching bullet casings to a previous attack.
Okay. You got to think, like, this dude now, like, if he hasn't been caught, the I imagine it happens to most of them, if they don't get caught, they start getting more and more positive that they are unstoppable.
Oh yeah, definitely bolster their confidence, won't it? They'll go, I can get away with this. You know, he got away with that rape, the attempted rape to begin with, because they didn't press charges, and now he's getting away with all this, you know, the two murders and the attempted murder in a day, and it's just getting crazy. On May the 14th, 1985, Ramirez returned to Monterey Park and entered the home of Bill Doy, 66, and his disabled wife Lillian, who was 56. Surprising Doy in his bedroom, Ramirez shot him in the face with the handgun. After beating the mortally wounded man into unconsciousness, Ramirez entered Lillian's bedroom and bound her with thumb cuffs.
So he didn't kill the guy, he shot him in the face, he wasn't dead.
Beat him.
Then beat him.
He's dying, though.
He
binds his wife with thumb cuffs, he raped her after he had ransacked their home for valuables, and Bill Doy died of his injuries at hospital. But his wife survived. He didn't kill her.
Fuck.
On the night of May 29th, 1985, Ramirez drove a stolen car to Monrovia and stopped at the house of Mabel Marbell, 83, and her disabled sister, Florence Nettie Lang, 81. It's fucking rank. What a bastard. Finding a hammer in the kitchen, he bludgeoned and bound Lang in her bedroom.
That's just crazy, isn't it? So this whole time he's staying at Skid Row.
At the Cecil. Then he bound and bludgeoned Belle before using an electrical cord to shock her. After raping Lang, he used Belle's lipstick to draw a pentagram on her thigh and on the walls of both bedrooms. The women were found 2 days later, alive but comatose, and Belle later died of her injuries.
Hmm.
Fucked up.
Yeah, that's not cool at all.
Horrible.
Yeah.
The next day, Ramirez drove the same car to Burbank and sneaked into the home of Carol Kyle, 42. At gunpoint, he bound Kyle and her 11-year-old son with handcuffs. Then he ransacked their house. He released Kyle to direct him to the valuables. He then raped her repeatedly. Ramirez also repeatedly ordered her not to look at him, telling her at one point that he would cut her eyes out.
Which he would have done.
Yeah. He fled the scene after retrieving the child from a closet and binding the two together again with handcuffs.
But he didn't kill them?
No.
Wow. Good. I didn't know what was going to go on in this little boy then.
Oh, no.
I was like, oh, God, not again.
Yeah.
Why did he not kill them? Why is he leaving evidence as such? Because these people could possibly say, which he did. We know he said, I'll cut your eyes out. So they're going to go, please go, it's the same guy as before, blah, blah, blah.
I was like, no, he's literally just doing whatever he feels
he
could like,
have
I suppose,
he could have got more,
isn't
he? He could have killed more people. He'd got a high number.
Yeah.
So it's not the high point of the MO.
Mm.
Robbery is.
Yeah.
Killing just happens to be something that he can do easily without any
killing
care.
Killing and raping.
And that does it if needs be, or feels like it, I guess.
Yeah.
Wow. How's that mind work?
I don't know, but it's like a frenzy, isn't it?
I'm looking forward to you telling me where he is now, or what's happened, or what's going on.
On the night of July the 2nd, 1985, he drove a stolen car to Arcadia and randomly selected the house of Mary Louise Cannon, 75. After quietly entering the widowed grandmother's house, he found her asleep in her bedroom. He bludgeoned her into unconsciousness with a lamp and then repeatedly stabbed her with a 10-inch butcher knife. She was found dead at the scene. On July the 5th, 1985, Ramirez broke into a home in Sierra Madre and bludgeoned 16-year-old Whitney Barrett with a tire iron as she slept in her bedroom. After searching in vain for a knife in the kitchen, Ramirez attempted to strangle the girl with a telephone cord. He was startled to see sparks coming from the cord, and when he saw his victim was still breathing, he fled the house, believing that God had intervened and saved her. Bennett survived the beating but needed 478 stitches.
Almost 500 stitches.
Yep. Crazy.
Hmm.
July 7th, 1985.
That's a frenzied attack, isn't it?
That's insane.
To stab that many times. Can you think about it? Duh, 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 but
that's fucking crazy.
Times 100.
July 7th, 1985. Ramirez burglarised the home of Joyce Lucille Nelson, 61, in Monterey Park. Finding her asleep on her living room couch, he beat her to death with his fists and kicked her in the head, leaving another imprint from his trainer, this time on the woman's face. After cruising two other neighbourhoods, he returned...
We've got a print, Chief. Where is it? It's on the victim's face.
Yeah, well, they've already got one, haven't they, from the flower bed that he left a few crimes back.
So
they've
now got
a cast of that, so they've got two footprints, two trainer prints now.
On a face? How can you leave an imprint? Print on a face, like the force from a pair of trainers as well.
Yeah, I know. We beat her with his fists, beat her to death. So fucking hell, he has actually got some.
He's got a lot of rage.
He's got the power of rage, isn't he?
Mm.
So after cruising two other neighbourhoods, he returned to Monterey Park and chose the home of Sophie Dickman, 63. Ramirez assaulted and handcuffed Dickman at gunpoint, attempted to rape her, and stole her jewellery.
Attempted to rape her?
Yeah. When she swore to him that he had taken everything of value, he made her swear to Satan.
Right.
I don't know what stopped him from raping her. I don't know why it wasn't a full on.
Did he have voices in his head?
I think he does get diagnosed as schizophrenic.
Going to go with the reason that he hasn't killed all these different things. I'm going at times that he kills, the voice in his head is saying kill them.
Well, yeah, because like that girl he tried to strangle, the one who needed nearly 500 stitches, you know, obviously he thought God had intervened and stopped that. So there's got to be some kind of religious mania thing
going on.
That's
why he's then saying, you know, pray to Satan or worship or, you know,
swear to Satan.
Why was this woman particularly Christian or Catholic?
No, it's just his thing, isn't it?
I was wondering if maybe she had a lot of religious things in her house and he was fucking with her. I don't think he's that clever.
No. July 20th, 1985, Ramirez purchased a machete before driving a stolen Toyota to Glendale. He chose the home of Layla Needing, 66, and her husband Maxon, 68. He burst into a sleeping couple's bedroom and hacked them with a machete, then killed them with shots to the head from the .22 caliber handgun. He further mutilated their bodies with a machete before robbing the house of any valuables. After quickly fencing the stolen items, Ramirez drove to Sun Valley.
Okay. He's just awful on one, isn't he?
Yeah, he's insane. That's what I mean. It's such a short time period. At approximately 4:15 a.m., he broke into the home of the Covanath family He shot the sleeping Chainerong, sorry, I'm going to massacre these names, in the head with a 25 caliber handgun, killing him instantly.
Then, I'm not sure if massacre is the correct word.
Yeah, sorry, bad choice of wording.
Yes.
Then repeatedly raped and beat Somkid Kovanath. He bound the couple's terrified 8-year-old son before dragging Somkid around the house to show him where the valuables were. During his assault, he demanded that she swear to Satan that she wasn't hiding any money from him.
Oh, so she... So he's using that... So, like, it's almost like, swear to God that you're not doing that.
Yeah.
But Satan.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
On August the 6th, Ramirez drove to Northridge and broke into the home of Chris and Virginia Peterson. He crept into the bedroom, startled Virginia, 27, and shot her in the face with a 25 caliber handgun.
That seems to be his MO, though.
Yeah, it's the gunshot.
Gunshot to the face.
I suppose it's quick, isn't it? It's quick.
What, it's a headshot?
No, going to disable him. He then shot Chris in the neck and attempted to flee. Chris fought back while avoiding being hit by two more shots during the struggle before Ramirez managed to escape, and the couple survived.
Wow, but yeah, the trauma that they're going to have.
I know, it was fucking mental, isn't it? Good on them, fuck me. What a story as well. Shot in the face by Richard Ramirez and lived to tell the tale.
Yeah, fought him off.
Fucking crazy. On August the 8th, Ramirez drove a stolen car to Diamond Bar and chose the home of Sakina Aberwath, 27, and her husband Elias Aberwath, 31. Sometime after 2:30 a.m., he entered the house and went into the master bedroom. He instantly killed the sleeping Elias with a shot to the head from the handgun. He handcuffed and beat Sakina while forcing her to reveal the locations of the family's jewellery, then brutally raped her. He repeatedly demanded that she swear on Satan that she would not scream during his assaults. When the couple's 3-year-old son entered the bedroom, Ramirez tied the child up and continued to rape Sakina.
Oh my God, any child shouldn't see any of this stuff. A 3-year-old child is going to be confused.
Yeah,
that's
definitely
going to be mummy.
There's quite a few kids involved that have seen, obviously, all this shit.
And they've then got to live with this.
Yeah.
And they're going to be around now.
Yeah, you know, traumatised. Ramirez left Sakina, untied her son and sent him to the neighbours for help. Poor kid. Ramirez, who had been following the media coverage of his crimes, left Los Angeles and headed to the San Francisco Bay Area. On August the 18th, he entered the home of Peter and Barbara Pan. He shot the sleeping Peter, 66, in the temple with the handgun, and then beat and sexually assaulted Barbara, 62, before shooting her and leaving her for dead. At the crime scene, Ramirez used lipstick to scrawl a pentagram and the phrase "Jack the Knife" on the bedroom wall.
What's that in?
I'm not sure.
Jack the Ripper?
I don't know. Maybe. Was it a Stone song?
"Mac the Knife."
That's probably an old
blues song.
Oh, okay. It was discovered that ballistics and shoe prints matched the previous crime scenes. Unfortunately, this information was leaked, and the then mayor of San Francisco also divulged this information on TV, which Ramirez saw, and he dropped his Avia trainers over the side of the Golden Gate Bridge. He remained in the area for a few more days before returning to Los Angeles. On August the 24th, Ramirez travelled 76 miles south of LA in a stolen orange Toyota to Mission Viejo. That night, he arrived at the home of James Romero Jr., who had just returned from a family vacation to Rosarito Beach in Mexico. Romero's son, 13-year-old James Romero III, happened to be awake and heard Ramirez's footsteps outside the house. Thinking there was a prowler, James went to wake his parents and Ramirez fled the scene. Fucking lucky escape. James raced outside and noted the colour, make and style of the car, as well as a partial number plate, and Romero contacted the police with this information. It's fucking good for him as well. 13-year-old kid got all that information.
So he's down at Cecil, but then he's nicking cars and driving.
Yeah, like he fucked off to San Francisco for a bit. Now he's back in Los Angeles.
He was in San Francisco the first deaf though, in the Tenderloin. But he was staying at Tenderloin, and he wasn't staying at the Access Hall at that point.
Yeah.
Then he went to LA.
Yeah, a couple of months after that, he moved to LA, and then
and chose the Cecil Hotel. And why did he choose Cecil Hotel? Because it's cheap.
Because it's cheap, and because in that area, turn a blind eye, and that sort of area.
So he chose that quite well. So again, the hotel and the way it is
made a perfect hiding place for him.
Evil to it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So after his encounter, Ramirez broke into the house of Bill Cairns, 30, and his fiancée Inez Erickson, 29, through a back door. Ramirez entered the sleeping couple's bedroom and awakened Cairns when he cocked his 25 caliber handgun. He shot Cairns 3 times in the head before returning his attention to Erickson. Ramirez told the terrified woman he was the Night Stalker and forced her to swear that she loved Satan as he beat her with his fists and bound her with neckties from the closet. After stealing what he could find, Ramirez dragged Erickson to another room to rape her. He then demanded cash and more jewellery and made her swear to Satan there was no more. Before leaving the home, Ramirez told Erickson, "Tell them the Night Stalker was here." Erickson untied herself and went to a neighbour's house to get help for her severely injured fiancé. Surgeons removed 2 of the bullets from his head and he survived his injuries.
So he is now with quite happily with the "I'm the Night Stalker, look at me, I'm quite happy for the infamy now."
Yeah, he likes
so
that.
So the fact that he's saying, "Tell them that was me." And he's, again, not killing them. So the voice is in his head saying, "Don't kill these victims, but..."
Yeah,
tell them it's me.
At the same time, I wonder if he started telling them that because he wants to get caught. You know, is he kind of
he's got an angel and a devil on his shoulders, and he's actually got a bit of moralness at all.
There comes a time with most serial killers where they kind
like we said, the Golden State Killer.
Yeah, like they want to be caught. You know, they want to end it, but they can't end it themselves.
Got to that point where they just stopped doing it.
Yeah.
And just went, "I can't be bothered anymore."
Yeah.
So you can imagine how much energy, the adrenaline rush is, I presume, you get from ending another human's life is quite a full-on thing. And an addiction.
I mean, you've got to think as well, with Ramirez, I mean, obviously we've already said, you know, he had a thing for LSD. You know, God knows what else he was on during this time. You know, was he all coked up? Was he fucking off his head? Meth, yeah. He must have been, like, some serious, serious drug addict, I would say. And probably from the state of his teeth,
I'd say. Imagine
walking
naked through the hotel and just look at him. You probably wouldn't want to stop him.
Would you fuck? Would you fuck approach that man?
Even if you ran into police, probably be like, "Oh, don't worry about it."
Look into his eyes, like you were saying earlier. You'd look into pictures of his eyes.
Yeah, he looks
it's
evil.
Just like there's nothing there.
Yeah,
you know, it's cold, dead eyes of a shark.
And
you imagine
that rage
him
as
covered
well,
in blood, naked. Who's going to say shit to him?
And that's just going to make him be more, "I'm invincible."
Yeah,
I'm
totally.
The fucking shit.
Yeah, of course.
No one's going to fuck with me.
No one's going to come near, are they?
I'm interested to find out how he gets captured and
it's really good actually. It's real like
because he's not
we're
a nice
just
guy.
Just about to kind of get near to that.
And this is so funny that this is our Cecil Hotel episode.
I know.
And yet we've just thrown in a serial killer because he lived there.
I'm going to be thrown in another serial killer soon as well.
Oh my god.
Oh, you got them all coming. There's stories aplenty. So getting back to this, that guy that survived from the previous attack, he gave a detailed description of Ramirez to the police, and the stolen car was found on August 28th in Wiltshire Centre. A single fingerprint was obtained from the rearview mirror, despite Ramirez obviously wiping the car down. The print was positively ID'd as belonging to Ramirez, who was described as a 25-year-old drifter from Texas with a long rap sheet including arrests for traffic and drug violations. The police decided to release his mugshot to the media at the police press conference. It was announced, "We know who you are now, and soon everyone else will too. There will be no place you can hide."
Okay. So this has been declared.
Yeah.
And what then? The capture's coming up. Is it a long time from this being declared and him being caught?
on, let me just double check that. Have I got a date for that?
I like throwing curveballs.
Yeah, well, no, I didn't think of that. Well, they found the stolen car on August the 28th in 85. No, not long at all, a couple of days.
Good.
So this is his capture now. It's a real, like, feel-good story for the people as well. I'm going to get this bugger. On August the 30th, 1985, Ramirez took a bus to Tucson, Arizona, to visit his brother. Unaware that his face was now on virtually every major newspaper and TV news program.
So he's gone to visit his brother.
Yeah.
So he's still in communicata with family members.
At least his brother, you know. So he's gone to visit him in Arizona.
Okay.
So he totally hasn't got a fucking clue that, like, his face is everywhere now. After failing...
And sorry. How is there a picture of his face everywhere? This is just through the
because
different
the police witnesses. The police have released his mugshot. They found the car.
Yeah.
They found a fingerprint on the car.
Yeah.
They ID'd it as Ramirez's because he's already been in trouble with the police for traffic and drugs.
Right.
They've got a mugshot of him. So now they've released the mugshot to the media. So now his face is all over the TV and the newspapers.
Back in the day, fingerprinting and that, to do that was actually a case of looking at fingerprints.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't have a computer going through.
They didn't have a database, did they?
No, so it's a case of
this
looking
is
through. How long would that take?
Yeah.
And aren't fingerprints a fucking fascinating thing? That
every
person has a individual one.
Yeah.
That is... How is that possible?
Crazy.
How can that be possible?
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's
I was thinking this recently.
So he failed to meet his brother and he returned to LA on August the 31st. So they found the car on the 28th, remember? And then they released his mugshot and everything. So we're now on August the 31st. He walked into a convenience store and after noticing a group of elderly Mexican ladies identifying him as El Matador, which means the killer.
Oh, killer, yes.
Ramirez saw his face on the newspaper and fled the store. After running across the Santa Ana freeway, he attempted to carjack a woman but was chased away by bystanders who pursued him. He was eventually caught and subdued by locals who beat the living shit out of him.
They proper beat the shit out of him.
I've watched a documentary and had an interview with two of the guys that caught him and they were like, yeah, beat him fucking shitless, absolutely, just beat the crap out of him, and hit him with metal bars, fucking everything, until the police arrived and took him into custody. So they've got him.
Good.
On September 20th, in 1989, Ramirez was convicted of all charges, 13 counts of murder, 5 attempted murders, 11 sexual assaults and 14 burglaries. During the penalty phase of the trial on November the 7th, 1989, he was sentenced to die in the gas chamber. He stated to reporters after the sentence, "Big deal, death always went with the territory. See you in Disneyland." The trial.
It's a random thing to say,
yeah, no. The trial cost $1.8 million, and in 2019 dollars, that is $3.71 million.
The trial.
Yeah, which at the time made it the most expensive in the history of California, until it was surpassed by the O.J. Simpson case in 1994.
Why does it cost so much?
Don't know. Witnesses,
because of
maybe,
so much intricacies,
fucking, yeah, all the stuff they've got to do,
coming
yeah.
together,
all the evidence they've got to put together,
Right, okay. So he's been caught and he's been sentenced to death.
Yeah, he's got the death sentence.
Right. He knew that though. Like you said, death comes with the territory. He knew that.
He don't give a fuck.
No, it's
got nothing to lose, has it?
What's it's
got
a
to
shame
lose?
To kill him.
Yeah,
it should just leave him to rot.
Mm.
You know, just leave him in a shit, solitary confinement. Let him go crazy.
Yeah.
I know. Then people go, it's unethical.
How much of a horrible person has this done?
Do it to him.
Not to justify something like that, but it's not even as if he did it to people that were an equal. Do you know what I mean? He's going for like really old ladies. What the fuck?
Well, regardless, like, he's done stuff to humans, which is just not. It's just not.
Yeah, and it's not fair that he should just get kind of snuffed out.
Yeah, because he's just going to be like, yeah, cool, wicked. You know, don't care. He's left. No, we're here in 2020, spending our afternoon, Sunday afternoon, chatting about him.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah. He's so, like, well-known as well.
Yeah, crazy.
Infamous. By the time of his trial, Ramirez had fans who were writing him letters and visiting him. Beginning in 1985, Doreen Loy wrote him nearly 75 letters during his incarceration. In 1988, Ramirez proposed to Loy, and on October 3rd, 1996, they were married in San Quentin State Prison. For many years, Loy said she would commit suicide when Ramirez was executed. However, she did eventually leave him. By the time of his death, Ramirez was engaged to a 23-year-old writer.
Okay, so there's the other side of it, which we don't want him to have a good time in prison.
Yeah.
I would... It should be like, no, he can't have pen pals.
Yeah, definitely. It shouldn't be allowed.
Cut it all off. He can have no outside thing. He sits in that cell and that's what he does.
Yep. End of. On August the 7th, 2006, Ramirez's first round of appeals ended unsuccessfully when the court upheld his convictions and death sentence. On September 7th, the court denied his request for a rehearing and he had appeals pending until the time of his death. Ramirez died of complications secondary to B-cell lymphoma.
So he didn't die from...
No, he didn't get death penalty.
Oh, so he didn't... Okay, so he died anyway.
He died in prison.
So natural cause...
So secondary... Hang on, you put me off there. Ramirez died of complications secondary to B-cell lymphoma, and lymphomas are blood cancers in the lymph nodes. And that was at Marin General Hospital in Greenbrae, California, on June the 7th, 2013.
Oh my God!
Oh,
really?
No, yeah.
Why didn't he get? Why? So
because it takes so long. It takes long to be
on death row.
For that to come round, I'll get to that in a sec.
So actually, we got what we wanted because I said I kind of.
Oh no, yeah.
So I kind of. I didn't realise. I was getting really angry,
going,
oh, right.
He had also been affected by chronic substance abuse, so there you go. He was like, on drugs all the time.
How was he looking in 2013 then, or 2012? He must have been looking awful. Yeah.
And chronic hepatitis C viral infection.
So he didn't have a good time in the end.
At 53 years old, he'd been on death row for more than 23 years.
Good little
fucker. So
there
you go. And that's the story of Richard Ramirez.
So he died from natural causes, but he had a horrible time towards the end, probably.
Yeah, he spent loads of times, time on death row, obviously, over 23 years. Do you know what I mean? I don't think they get put in a cell with someone else, do they, on death row?
I'm going to have to look into...
I don't know how it works.
I'm going to have to look into his prison time, then. There must be some sort of documentary or something on him in prison. So it's like Charlie Manson, really, because Manson only died not that long ago.
Yeah.
And he ended... Was he on death row, Manson? I'm not sure.
Oh, I don't know. But, I've not really looked into him too much. I think Charles Manson's a bit of a fucking fanny, to be honest.
Well, you know, the Manson thing, really, the CIA and all that. But that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, that was quite interesting, actually, that podcast about Manson and the CIA.
Yeah.
I'm well up for that.
I love
a conspiracy.
Yeah. I don't know if that's conspiracy.
Yeah.
I can't believe that one, to be honest with you.
Ooh.
I know.
I'll start on your tinfoil hat tonight, dear.
Oh, thank you. So there you go. There's a horrible, horrible bastard who lived at the Cecil Hotel.
What a dick, eh?
And he used that as his point. So when he was arrested, he still had his place at the Cecil. So he'd had... What did he have in his room today?
I don't know.
I wonder what his belongings were.
Yeah, I did try and find out what number room he was in.
He doesn't sound like a person who could have a record collection.
Yeah.
Well, he might do. He might be trying to play records backwards.
Maybe.
Summon the Dark Lord.
Oh, God.
Wow.
Step away, Ramirez.
Wow. And that's crazy, we've not even got to the end of this hotel yet.
Not at all. Like, that's
right,
so
everyone,
crazy
grab your popcorn.
Well.
We're still in.
go and put,
make that,
put
the seatbelts on.
Yeah. Put the kettle on, get a cup of tea because it was still going.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, so that's Ramirez. Crazy as well. Like, obviously, I know about Ramirez. I know I've known a lot of information and stuff about him, but it's bonkers to go through all the stuff that he did in that quick of a time. You know, yeah. For me to sit here and read that out, that's quite flipping shocking. And it was a bit like, oh, some of them.
I actually thought your voice was cracking a little bit at times.
Yeah,
just
really
when you're reading them out.
To think
yeah,
about
I
it.
Thought you'd get a little
been
upset.
Doing the notes and kind of writing it.
But when
but
to actually
it
read it out, that's the thing. When your actually brain's actually thinking about reading
really
it.
Really awful. What a bastard. Right, so we are going to now get on to a guy called Jack Unterweger.
So
this guy stayed at the Cecil Hotel.
Now, is this the dude that looked up to Ramirez and wanted to stay in his room?
He ended up staying in the same room as Ramirez. He was quite a fan of Ramirez, so he specifically got his room when he went to stay at the Cecil.
So all right, you're going to go through this dude is in obviously not as much detail as Ramirez. So he hasn't got as much of a long
rap sheet. But even so, like, this guy's quite unheard of, I would say. You know, I know quite a lot about serial killers and stuff, and I was a bit like, oh, I've heard his name kind of bandied about a bit, but I never actually knew what he got up to. So this guy is quite a bit of an unknown. But yeah, this guy stayed at the Cecil too.
And he specifically said, can I stay... or he found out, obviously, what room it was and said, can I stay at 412 or whatever?
Yeah. I really did try and find out what room it was, but I couldn't find out. I'm sure they probably do it for a reason.
Definite reason.
There's a reason behind
yes.
that.
Yes, other people like yourself don't go, I could book a holiday.
Oh, no. I did think, would I?
No.
I was like, would
I?
Well,
I'm going to say to you,
that?
No. I don't want to really have a hotel in Skid Row. Yeah. I don't really want to have a room in Rich Ramirez's room either.
Yeah, that's a bit scary, isn't it? Well, I think if I was going to stay there, I'd probably stay next door. I don't know if I'd be able to stay in his room. I think that's a bit like...
No, it's horrible.
He's not a pleasant man, is he, at all?
No, not really.
Okay, so this guy stayed at the Cecil in 1991. He's a writer, and he was writing about crime in LA.
He's a writer writing about crime specifically. He's been writing about crime in other places. Is he a novelist, or is it for newspaper articles or magazine?
This was for a magazine.
So he's a magazine writer.
He's not specifically a magazine writer.
He's just a writer.
We will get into...
Oh, okay,
I'm going to get into his whole
backstory.
Sorry.
Okay, cool, wicked.
We'll get into that, and you'll see his life.
Okay.
So Johann Jack Unterweger was born in 1951 to Theresia Unterweger, a Viennese barmaid and waitress, and Jack Becker, an American soldier, whom she met in Trieste, Italy. Unterweger's mother was jailed for fraud while she was pregnant, but she was released and travelled to Graz, where he was born. After his mother was arrested again in 1953, Unterweger was sent to Carinthia to live with his grandfather, who was known as a rough fellow, who regularly enlisted his grandson to help him steal farm animals.
Grab that pig! Grab that pig!
Pig wrestling. Unterweger was in and out of prison for much of his youth, and he worked as a waiter, but between 1966 and 1974 he was convicted 16 times, mostly for theft-related offences, but also for pimping and sexual assault on a sex worker. He spent most of those 8 years in jail. In 1974, Unterweger murdered 18-year-old German Margaret Schaefer by strangling her with her own bra. And in 1976, he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. While he was in prison, though, he wrote short stories, poems, plays, and an autobiography called Purgatory, or The Trip to Prison, Report of a Guilty Man, that later served as the basis for a documentary. In 1985, a campaign to pardon and release Unterweger began. Austrian...
From who?
Fucking everybody. It's insane. Like, when I was doing the notes, it's just like, what the fuck was going on here? Loads of people got involved in this campaign to get him out of prison.
They must have been something. He was a murderer.
It was just because of all this stuff that he'd written. They were like, oh, he's amazing. You know, everybody loved him. You're
even
like,
though he can still fucking write.
Yeah, they're like, oh, you've got to get him out of there. It's crazy. Austrian President Rudolf Kirchschläger refused the petition when presented to him, citing the court-mandated minimum of 15 years in prison. Writers, artists, journalists and politicians all got involved in the campaign.
How do they feel later on then?
I know.
Did they go, oh...
Yeah.
Got that wrong,
just
didn't we?
Do a homework.
We thought it's just an artistic.
Back into the bushes, yeah. Quietly. Unterweger was released on the 23rd of May 1990 after the required 15 years had been served. Upon his release.
Oh, so he did do the.
He did 15 years.
Okay.
But he originally got life.
Well,
whatever life means, I think it's 25 years, is it?
Yeah,
it's a general. Thing
and the people what they
unless they get go people life do the, things,
you get
life
people do like 3 years,
yeah,
so good behaviour and all that,
yeah. Upon his release, his autobiography was taught in schools and his stories for children were performed on Austrian radio. Unterweger himself hosted TV programmes which discussed criminal rehabilitation. And he worked as a reporter public broadcaster where he reported on stories concerning the very murders for which he was later found guilty.
Brilliant. This seems like now this guy's actually come out and gone, I can change this around.
Yeah.
I can go out, I can tell you about what, blah, 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 and use this in a positive way. But no, he fucks up.
Yeah. Well.
Drugs involved?
He uses that as a cover. I would say as a double bluff, I suppose. Like, oh,
this
don't
must
look
have
at
been
me.
When,
I'm
when,
the good boy.
When the case
over
was cracked later on, then that must have been like controversial. Everyone like, oh my god! Like, do you know what I mean? Wow, this is fascinating.
Yeah. So, in 1991, an Austrian magazine hired Unterweger to write about crime in LA and the differences between US and European attitudes to prostitution. Unterweger was a fan of Richard Ramirez and stayed in the same room as him in the Cecil Hotel during his time in LA.
It feels like a Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas type thing. Hunter
yeah.
S. Thompson,
yeah,
just,
totally.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Really getting into it and, yeah.
He met with local police and even went for ride-alongs to the city's red light district. So he was contacted the police, yeah, and went for ride-alongs, and they were taking him all over the place, you know, and taking him down to Skid Row, showing him what they were doing.
I'm totally fascinated with what you're going to tell me about what's going to happen then.
During Unterweger's time in LA, three sex workers were beaten, sexually assaulted with tree branches, and strangled with their own bras.
Was he a fan of the Evil Dead?
Oh, yeah. Tree rape. In Austria, Unterweger had been suggested as a suspect for some other murders that had happened. There had been 7 murders in Austria in 1990 of sex workers before he'd gone over to LA.
So he was potentially
they'd been suggested, but
they've not been proven.
That he was. Well, we'll get on to that.
Oh, okay.
You're jumping the gun. You're eager, Pickle. You're eager.
I got excited.
So, yeah, back in Austria, just before he'd nicked off to LA, there had been several sex workers who'd been killed, beaten and garrotted with their own bras. So he uses that every single time. He takes their bra off and he strangles them with it. So in Austria, they're on his case. He'd been suggested as a suspect for the other murders and the police had kept him under surveillance for a bit before he went, until he left for the US, but they couldn't find any evidence to connect him. So eventually the police, they found enough evidence to issue a warrant for his arrest. There was the police in Graz where he murdered the other sex workers, but he had fled by the time they entered his home. After law enforcement agencies chased him and his girlfriend through Switzerland, France and the US, he was finally arrested by the US Marshals in Miami on the 27th of February 1992.
So he was at the hotel investigating this.
Yeah. But before he was at the hotel,
yeah, they he'd thought murdered. He had murdered. He'd, so then yeah. they, but then he'd gone. He'd finished yeah. doing what he was doing he'd in
fucked,
LA.
Fucked off to LA. Went back to his home. Yeah.
So he murdered in LA.
Yeah. Got away with it there. He's got away with so many. You know, that's what I mean. It's crazy that he's like quite unheard of. Because what's that like? 10, 11 murders.
So he came back. Then they okay.
9 murders, sorry. Yeah, he was extradited to Austria on May the 27th, 1992, and charged with 11 homicides, including one which occurred in Prague and 3 in LA. So he's getting charged for all of them.
So is there any comment from the people that said that, free him?
No, they're all keeping quiet now.
Of course they are.
The jury found him guilty of 9 murders. Based on psychiatric evaluation, Unterweger was diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, which is characterised by exaggerated feelings of self-importance, an excessive need for admiration, and a lack of empathy towards other people. On the 29th of June 1994, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And that night, Unterweger committed suicide at Graz Carlo prison by hanging himself with a rope made from shoelaces and the cord from his tracky bottoms, using the same knot that was found on all the strangled prostitutes.
So, why was he allowed shoelaces and...
I don't know.
Surely they take
I thought they
away.
Would have took him away.
Like slip-on shoes and all that
yeah.
jazz.
Yeah.
Because he did basically why you take that shit
yeah,
away.
Yeah, definitely. Just, don't let like, you have anything like
he,
that.
So he got off... from fucking committing
yeah.
suicide.
Yeah, he killed himself.
Just, I'll get out of here, fuck this.
Yeah.
What a cunt.
Mm.
Okay.
So that's the story of Jack Unterweger.
So that's insane. This dude was already a killer. Then like, we'll pay you to go to LA and check out the crime scene and prostitution scene yeah. and stuff. And we'll pay for you to stay in a hotel. I'll stay in the hotel of that Richard Ramirez character.
Yeah.
May as well kill a few people there.
You know, he got away with
he
it.
He would have thought that. As soon as they said
there.
That, he'd been like, oh, I'm going to kill some
prostitutes. Now's my opportunity.
Kill some prostitutes while I'm there.
You know, Ramirez got away with it while he was living there, so he obviously felt the same. And obviously,
so another serial killer has stayed at the Cecil Hotel.
Two serial killers that we know of that have stayed there.
Like we know of. Yeah. Like you're leaving out a little in there.
Well, yeah, you never know, do you? Yep, so... now we are going to go on to the fairly famous case of Elisa Lam that also happened yeah. at the Cecil.
This is
more kind of, I don't want to say modern day.
No, this is recent.
I suppose, yeah.
This is very recent with better. The advent of social media and technology.
Yeah.
This was... something I covered this on the podcast on Haunted Hill episode 1. We did like a we did a little thing on the strange world of strange segment. We talked about it a little bit. This is a case where, ladies and gentlemen, you can actually watch the video footage yourself. Now, personally, we did watch something which kind of debunked it a little bit not long ago, and that I'm going along with, and I'm going to say my thoughts at the end. But this is still quite a mysterious thing. I think it's a fairly straight answer to what's going on, and it's not that mysterious. But in the look at it, and if you just watch the video footage, it is weird as fuck.
Yeah, definitely, because I hadn't seen the actual video footage until fairly recently, actually.
Yeah.
And I was like really weirded out by it.
Yeah, it's a CCTV footage basically from elevators and corridors around the hotel. All right, do you want to explain who this lady was?
Okay, so Elisa Lam, she was born on April the 30th, 1991. She disappeared on the 31st of January 2013. Her body was discovered on the 19th of February in 2013. She was the daughter of emigrants from Hong Kong who opened a restaurant just outside Vancouver in Canada, and she was a student at the University of British Columbia. She'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is characterised by periods of depression and abnormally elevated moods. And she had been prescribed 4 different medications to treat these. So in mid-2010, Elisa began a blog and filled it with fashion photos and accounts of her life, particularly her struggle with mental illness. In January 2012, she posted that a relapse had forced her to drop several classes, leaving her feeling directionless and lost. She decided to travel to California for a break, and her parents were worried about her travelling alone, but she promised she would ring them every day. She arrived in Los Angeles on January 26th, and after 2 days, she checked into the Cecil, which was then called the Stay on Main. She was initially assigned a shared room on the hotel's fifth floor. However, her roommates complained about her certain odd behaviours, and she was moved to a room of her own. It's never kind of gone into what her behaviours were there. There aren't any interviews with the people that stayed in the room with her or anything. You know, it's never discussed. So I don't know what that would be.
It might just been annoying.
Yeah, I mean, people, you know, what is odd behaviour to some people?
It's not for that.
It might not be categorically odd. Interviews with her roommates from this time have never been released. On January 31st, 2013, the day she was scheduled to check out of the Cecil and leave for Santa Cruz, her parents did not receive their daily phone call, and worried, they called the LAPD to report her disappearance. Hotel staff who saw Lam that day said she was alone. Outside the hotel, the manager of a nearby bookstore was the only person who recalled seeing her that day. She said she was outgoing and lively, and she was talking about the book she was planning on buying, worrying it would be too heavy to carry with her while she was travelling. Police searched the hotel to the extent that they legally could, searching Elisa's room and even having sniffer dogs go through the building, but nothing was found. On February the 6th, a week after Elisa had last been seen, the LAPD decided more help was needed, and flyers with her picture were posted in the neighbourhood and online, which brought the case to the public attention through the media. On the 15th of February, after another week with no sign of Elisa, the LAPD released a video of the last known sighting of her, taken in one of the Cecil's elevators by a video surveillance camera on the 1st of February. In the video, Elisa enters the lift and goes to the control panel, appearing to select several floors. She steps back out and into the corner of the lift. She kind of jumps out into the hallway, doesn't she? It's quite weird.
It's really fascinating CCTV footage. We watched quite a lot of this stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, we watched a documentary of it and stuff.
And just this particular, yeah. But it's so cool nowadays. Cool is, I don't know if that's the correct word, all the time. That we can observe these things with CCTV footage. This follows, like, traces her journey, and the footage, when you first watch it straight away, it's like she's hiding from someone's after her.
That's what it comes across like that. But when it says, but like, then it she's starts gesturing getting a bit weirder. To someone else, I don't think she is. It kind of doesn't look like that.
No, it's not. I'll get to what I think at the end, but
okay,
that's how it looks in the CCTV footage. It looks like she's hiding, she doesn't know to get in the lift, she's scared of someone or something. Yeah. There's no sound of the footage, obviously.
No.
So make of it as you will, but it is definitely weird and creepy, especially as she becomes a missing persons case.
Yeah, I do find it weird that the doors don't close on the lift as well while she's kind of going in and out, but would that just be down to a sensor?
There's a sensor on the door.
Yeah.
It'd be lower down, and every time she... Yeah,
Because she does kind of move in front of the doors quite a lot.
The elevators nowadays, you know, very quite good majority of them. Admittedly, this is an old building, but no, I don't, you know.
So there's several theories about her actions. One is that she was trying to get the elevator to move because she was trying to escape someone who was coming after her. It's also suggested that she may have been under the influence of ecstasy or some other drug, but I don't think she looks like that.
Well, we know with the post-mortem.
Yeah. None was detected in her system. When her bipolar disorder became known, the theory that she was having a psychotic episode emerged, and it has also been speculated that she may have been playing the elevator game.
Now, I don't know what this elevator game is. Mm. You've mentioned it a couple of times.
So it's quite spooky, actually. I wouldn't want to play it. I don't particularly believe it. I don't particularly believe that she was playing it.
How can it be spooky? You in an elevator.
It sounds scary.
How's it scary?
Okay, so this is the elevator game. The Korean elevator game is a procedure that is apparently designed to open doors to another dimension. To play, you need to find a building that's at least 10 stories high. Enter the elevator alone at ground level. Select, I'd never remember all these fucking buttons anyway. Select the fourth floor. At the fourth floor, do not get out. Instead, select the button for the second floor. When you reach that, stay inside the elevator and go to the sixth floor. Stay inside when you reach it and select the second floor. And when you get there, select the tenth floor. When you reach that one, go to the fifth. And when you reach the fifth floor, apparently a woman will get into the lift. You must not look at her or talk to her, even if she attempts to engage you in conversation, because apparently she asks you where you're going, but you can't talk to her. From here, you must select the first floor, and if the elevator actually moves up to the 10th floor instead, like, you can go on with the game. But if the elevator goes down to the first floor, you have to get out and don't look back. If instead you do reach the 10th floor, you have two choices. You can stay in the elevator or you can go out. If you leave the elevator, the woman may ask you where you're going again, but you're not to acknowledge her in any way. Look around at the 10th floor. If you are the only person present there, you have reached the alternative dimension. Apparently, numerous people who have claimed to reach this point insist that there is nothing but blackness outside each of the building's windows. The only thing that can be seen is a bright glowing red cross in the distance. If you decide not to venture out at the 10th floor, you simply need to press the button for the first floor to get home. When you arrive, exit the elevator without acknowledging the woman.
Fuck off.
I would not remember all those buttons.
So, let's say the person that's written down these rules, they've sat there and worked this out of like, oh, I went to level 5, wrong level, have to go back to it again. Oh, yeah. Eventually, of all these numbers and combinations, I've got it right, and there's a black.
Yeah.
And then they wrote, oh, basically write that down. Okay, wicked, nice, so I get back in there, put it on the internet. Fuck off.
I know.
I'll do it with you, but film it.
I don't want to go to a bloody alternative dimension. What if it works? I'm not going to remember all them bleeding numbers anyway. You're supposed to do it alone.
Oh. I'll do it then.
Oh, no, you're not allowed. Quite fond of you. Disappear in a bloody alternative dimension.
So people thought she was playing this game.
Yeah, hang on, I've still got some more going that. If you have explored the 10th floor, you'll need to press all the buttons in the same order you did before, finishing on the 5th. From the 5th, you can then select the 1st. In some cases, the elevator will apparently attempt to take you straight back to the alternative reality. Keep pressing any button to stop this ascension before arriving at the 10th floor.
What happens if you get there again?
I know. Once you get back to the first floor, do not leave the elevator until you have double-checked everything is in place. If anything's off, repeat the process, pressing all the buttons in the same order that you did earlier, ending on the 5th. From here, you can attempt the real first floor again.
If you it seems a bit of a falafel. It doesn't seem, if you're mentally ill, possibly, to be the best hotel to choose to play the game if you're going to.
Yeah.
It's probably like the worst hotel to do it in.
God's sake.
The lady herself was American Korean, I think.
What, Elisa? She was Canadian. Hong Kong Canadian.
Hong Kong Canadian?
Yeah. Her parents had emigrated from Hong Kong, opened a restaurant in Vancouver, didn't they?
Sorry, I said that
bit at the beginning, dear.
Sorry. I'll keep up with all of it.
That's the elevator game. That seems like such a pain in the arse.
It does seem possible she might have been playing that from looking at the footage. Remembering back the footage where she darts out looking back and forward, that does kind of seem like a thing. And like, she does have mental health problems.
Yeah.
I think combinations. Well, we're getting to my thoughts. Let's continue with what's happening for...
Okay, so during the search for Elisa, guests at the hotel began complaining about low water pressure, and some complained their water was coloured black and
this
had an unusual
gross.
Taste. On investigation of the water tanks that were on the roof of the Cecil, Elisa's body was found on the morning of February the 19th, floating face down, totally naked, in one of the four 1,000-gallon tanks that provided water to guests' rooms, a kitchen and a coffee shop.
So people are drinking juices.
Yeah, decaying body gunk in your water.
Wouldn't that make you ill?
Yeah, well, I would think so.
It's going to give some bad bacteria
yeah,
virus.
Yeah, definitely. It's got to be...
Possibly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's got to give you at least give some you the shit, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
It can make you sick. The tank was drained and cut open as the maintenance hatch was too small to accommodate the equipment needed to retrieve her body. On the 21st of February, the LA Coroner's Office issued a finding of accidental drowning with bipolar disorder as a significant factor. The full coroner's report was issued in June, stating that Elisa had been found naked. Clothing similar to what she was wearing in the elevator video was also found floating in the water, covered in a sand-like particulate. Her watch and room key were also found with her. There was no evidence of physical trauma, sexual assault or suicide. A toxicology test showed traces consistent with prescription meds plus Sinutab and ibuprofen. And a very small amount of alcohol was present, but no other recreational drugs were found.
And I'm agreeing with their conclusion.
Yeah.
Her, the toxicology report was at least 9 different medicines she had in her system at the time. Mental illness being a factor. Now, someone
definitely.
Did... Because obviously, what you want to do... is if you want to go to the creepy side of it or the weird and strange and unusual, looking at the video footage and her behaviour, it straight away influences that thought, train of thought, straight away when you watch that.
Yeah.
But looking at the case more, really, it is a case of... Because someone did... After it had been done, they're like, "That's it. We're gonna lock this door up. You can't get through this door. Blah blah blah. Now be secure." Only so like a couple of weeks later, someone with their camcorder, with their phone, filmed doing the exact thing.
They got on the roof,
and
they
went straight up the same steps.
Yeah.
And they opened the door. It was open.
Yeah.
And to get on a tank, it looks like how on earth do you get up onto a tank? You go around to the other side. I think it's the adjoining building.
Mm.
That's what I was saying to you about the building idea.
Yeah.
Adjoining building, and you go up the steps and you come back over, then you're looking down a tank. You do have to come down a wall, maybe 5 feet or so, down onto the one of the two huge tanks. Then there's a square bit which you open up, which is obviously the bit which is what she got into. I personally think, because just before this also, her Instagram posts were a lot of rooftop photos.
Yeah.
So if she was having an episode, there's very high chance that she was there to take a photo of a rooftop and maybe got on the tower thinking maybe it was a good idea to stand here and get an angle or something, I don't know, or whatever, and fell down the hole. I don't know, that part is a little bit weird, but you can understand her going up there, getting able to get up there. That obviously the weird bit is the before bit, the elevator thing going on. Those bits, it does seem a bit weird, but it's not, I guess that's the only thing which Chuck in there makes it a bit weird. Otherwise it'd just be a maybe open shut case almost. She's went up there to take a photo.
Yeah, well, I suppose,
fell in the water,
but like,
tank.
If she fell in the water tank, why has she got no clothes on? Why is she in there naked? If she just went up there to take a picture of from the roof
maybe
and
she
fell
took,
in.
Maybe she took her clothes off to try and tie together to... get out. I don't know. I can't complete the
I don't know. It's so weird. Like, I'm just thinking, how would I attempt to explain that?
I know.
I don't know. I think maybe she was having some kind of a manic episode, which helped all this along. But I feel like, as in a quotation marks, normal mindset, would find it difficult to know what was probably going on in her head, you know. But at the same point, it's, I say only, it is bipolar and depression, isn't it? So it's not anything typically maniacal, but like the voices nine, in the head.
The nine
telling
types of medicine
her to
in
her
body, the combination, you know. I don't know. I think really you could come out with your own verdict.
Yeah.
But ladies and gents, do check out the video footage of Elisa Lamb.
Well, we can post it, can't we?
Oh, we can
post,
we'll
stick
we can post
it up on
the Facebook page, but not everyone's on Facebook.
Yeah, and I'll stick up a few pictures of the water tanks and stuff like that up on the Facebook
page. It's a fascinating watch.
Yeah, definitely.
In the lifts, cause it does sort of creep you out a bit.
Yeah.
Especially if she went and then went missing. Mm. That must have been before they actually found her. That whole bit of her missing, just that footage, must have been like, this is creepy as fuck.
Yeah, they must have been thinking, like, what the fuck is going on, you know? Mm. So,
and it's good so the parents got on it straight away, though, to ring up and say missing persons after just not receiving one phone call. That must have been like a person
who
dedicates themselves to making phone calls all the
time.
Yeah, they knew. So that's what I'm saying, though. So good on them for doing that. But then again, it's still too late because the terribleness had already been done.
Yeah.
So that's Lisa Lamb, and that's still, blimey, that's still at this bloody hotel.
Yeah.
Like, this hotel cannot get a break.
Oh, yeah. Well, nothing's happened in recent years that I could find. That was the last thing.
That was 2012? 2013, I think.
Yeah.
It's not that long ago, but still, that's okay.
Yeah, so...
That's kind of good, I guess. Nothing else happened.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yes. And that's pretty much the story of the Cecil Hotel.
That's crazy.
Just a little kind of aside. There was obviously the Black Dahlia murder that happened in 1947.
That was a very violent
that
case.
Lady,
the,
yeah,
the woman
that was
really,
really crazy.
Cut up bad.
That was Elizabeth Short, and she was reported to have stayed or been seen at the Cecil in like the days before her body was found. Apparently that's not true. There's no proof that she was ever there, and they think it was the Biltmore Hotel that she was last seen at, which is just across town from the Cecil.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the Cecil. But yeah, the Black
Dahlia, and the death wasn't there anyway. It's just the death
she was
in LA.
She was found murdered in the Laymark Park neighbourhood of LA in 1947. Her corpse had been savagely mutilated. Her face had been slashed from the corners of her mouth to her ears. She was bisected at the waist, and her intestines tucked neatly beneath her buttocks, and her corpse had been posed, hands behind her head, elbows bent, and legs spread apart. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah,
made
definitely.
Made a movie about that.
Such a crazy murder, and that's always been unsolved. They've never found who did that.
You
can see the photos of that as well, and I've seen them. It's fucking crazy. I did look at them.
Of course you did. Mm. That person that could have stood out there then, or was.
Yep. So yeah, that's bonkers.
They'd be quite old by now.
Yeah.
If still alive. Okay, well.
And yeah, that's the story of the Cecil Hotel. Okay. If you fancy carrying on your hotel themed kind of things, obviously American Horror Story Hotel was based on the Cecil.
What season's that?
Season 5, I think it is.
Any good?
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah. Really good. Yeah,
Ramirez
is in it. Eileen Wuornos, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy.
Why are all these silly critters?
Because they all gather at the hotel. It is based on the Cecil. It's kind of half based on H.H. Holmes' murder hotel as well.
Yeah. That's crazy. Though.
So then every night on Halloween in the American Horror Story, they have a Devil's Night where all the serial killers kind of get invited to come and have a party with the guy that used to own the hotel, who was a murderer as well. So he gets them all together and they all have dinner. But it's really quite good.
Oh, I might check it out.
Yeah,
H.H. Holmes, that's
really
another
good
hotel.
Oh, yeah.
Which is.
See,
if
I knew
you don't.
I knew this episode was going to be really long, so I did want to squeeze in I did think, squeeze in HH Holmes as well, but
it's a different
because
hotel.
It's a different place. It's just
it's different
like
part of America as well. But that is insane, the HH Holmes. If you don't know about that, a dude that just made a house with doors which would go to brick walls, and just then he had a, like torture bit in the basement,
shoots and stuff like that.
It was insane. The dude made a hotel to murder people coming from the World Trades Fair.
That's
craziness. But that's another crazy fucker.
Yeah.
There's many crazy fuckers out here. I think we could carry on doing podcast episodes for days and days.
So many. So you can watch American Horror Story Hotel series. It's really cool. Obviously, The Shining, Psycho, or the series Bates Motel, Vacancy, The Witches, and The Innkeepers, and obviously 1408 as well. And Stephen King said, I did look into that because I was like, did he base that on the Cecil?
But, no, I watched that. For prep for this, I watched it.
Yeah, I did too. But he said 1408 was inspired by the Hotel Del Coronado in California, not the Cecil. But there's definite similarities between
loads of them. After listening to what we said today, you could watch that and just imagine it quite easily more. Or the other way around.
Totally.
Innkeepers
as Innkeepers. Well. It's a really good movie to watch as well, that. If you like horror.
I saw the premiere. So I saw that in cinema.
Yeah.
And that bit with the naked guy.
That's
not many times it's happened to me in a cinema, but that legitimately gave back my neck when,
Yeah, it's really creepy because it's quite a like unassuming
don't spoil
movie.
It, though. Yeah. It's a slow burn, so yeah. High West.
And then that happens. Yeah. It's like, ugh.
And then he shot it there because he was staying there on production of another film. Okay. Like the hotel. It's like, oh, let's do this.
Yeah.
So it's quite cool.
Yeah, it's a decent film.
Yeah, it's not bad. Wow.
So
thanks.
There you go. Hotel Cecil.
You can chill out now.
Excellent.
Don't have to worry about doing hotels and things.
Yeah. That's all right. It was interesting. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. That is a crazy hotel, and I'll have to look at it again another time I'm in LA.
Definitely. I'd like to go and get shifty at it.
Even just to go and have a little look at it and stuff.
Yeah. But so I'll whack some pictures up on the Facebook page of all the different
bits
and
Lisa
bobs
Lamb
associated
stuff.
With it. The video of her. And
yeah, absolutely. What we could do for episode 8?
Look who's stalking.
Look who's stalking. That's going to be a funny episode. We have to call
stalkers.
It Look Who's Stalking.
Yeah, definitely. We're going taking a look at the world of the stalker next time.
Then we could do like Look Who's Stalking part 2, can't we, later on? That's hilarious. Yeah, we're doing stalking, so we're just going to do like we're going to pick some cases. I think just briefly and talk
to
generally.
There's
tons, and we've got a couple.
We've
got a couple.
Already,
one was just insane.
That one we're watching last night
was
crazy. That was crazy.
That's just like that ending when the police are like, we've arrested the stalker.
Yeah.
You have to listen next time to hear that because that is an insane like twist.
Definitely.
But yeah, I mean, enjoyed talking about the hotel. It's good. The Ramirez is an evil bastard, so I'm glad he died
totally.
In prison.
Yeah.
You know. Cool. Wicked. That's it.
Yes, that's it. That's your lot for this week. This time.
No, well, wicked. Well, thanks for coming along on this little journey with us to the Cecil Hotel. We were your tour guides. And in this window, someone jumped out and committed suicide. In this window, they threw their baby out the window.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. In this room was two serial killers who stayed here. All right, nice one.
Cool.
We'll see you again next time.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Bye.
Goodbye.
If you like this show, please check out the podcast on Haunted Hill and deadboltfilms.com for all our independent horror films.